Dr. William Luther Pierce, 2001. As Ye Sow.
Hello. First, I want to admit to an error I made in last week's broadcast. I attributed to the circus impresario P.T. Barnum the statement that no one ever lost a nickel by underestimating the intelligence of the American public. At least two alert listeners have since pointed out to me that the statement actually was made by the journalist and writer H.L. Mencken. The statement for which P.T. Barnum should be remembered is that a sucker is born every minute. Last week, we talked about the rewards of increasing diversity in America. The primary reward is the growth in alienation as young Americans fail to develop a healthy sense of racial identity and fail to find satisfactory role models. Diversity goes up and homogeneity simultaneously goes down. And as homogeneity goes, so goes the individual's sense of community, of belonging, of identity. And we also talked about many of the side benefits of diversity. Rising suicide rates, a greatly increased incidence of neuroses and psychopathologies, more schoolyard shootings, a growing pregnancy rate among young, unwed white teenagers, the confusion and loss of values, lowered academic standards, the trashing of the history and literature curricula in our universities, and a number of other consequences of the diversity being visited upon us by the government and the Jewish media. And America is not the only nation ruined by the diversity mongers. If you've been paying attention to the news of what's happening in the Balkans, you will have noticed that the bloodshed and misery begun there by the determination of Madeleine Albright and the Clinton government to ram multiculturalism down the throats of the Serbs is still spreading. The killing going on in Macedonia now is a direct consequence of the Clinton government's bombing of Belgrade in order to force the Serbs to accept the multiculturalization of Serbia's Kosovo province. If you remember, the excuse given by Madeleine Albright and her kosher crew was that the wicked Serbs were mistreating the Albanian minority in Kosovo, who merely wanted to live in multicultural bliss with the Serbs. Well, of course, the Albanians wanted no such thing. They wanted exactly what the Serbs wanted, namely to have Kosovo all to themselves. So as soon as Madeleine's hired gunmen shifted the balance of power in Kosovo and forced the Serb army out, the Albanians, instead of hugging their Serb neighbors, began killing and terrorizing them. The Serbs fled for their lives, and now the Albanians run Kosovo, except for a few all-Serb enclaves. And more recently, the Albanians have decided that what worked in Kosovo should work in neighboring Macedonia, where they also have a sizable minority. And so now we have Slavs and Albanians killing each other in Macedonia. What the Clinton government's effort to multiculturalize Kosovo has done, in other words, is cause the bloodshed and violence and unhappiness in the area to increase greatly. Before Madeleine, there was a more or less peaceful status quo. Serbs occasionally killed Albanians, and Albanians occasionally killed Serbs. Now, there is chaos and wholesale bloodshed. Without outside coercion, people generally choose to live among their own kind. Sometimes, they fight against other ethnic or racial groups, but the fighting is minimized by maintaining separation and allowing the various groups to run their own affairs and live according to their own customs. Then a multiculturalist comes along and tells everyone that it is wicked for people to mind their own business, that what they should do instead is mind everyone else's business, and the result is great unhappiness for everyone concerned, except for the multiculturalist, who sees his work as minding other people's business and forcing people to live with people they don't want to live with. Actually, the multiculturalists began their lethal meddling in the Balkans a long time ago. After the First World War, they thought it would be nice to take a bunch of different peoples, Croats and Serbs and Slovenes and Montenegrins and Albanians and Macedonians, some Muslim, some Catholic, some Eastern Orthodox, abolish the boundaries between them and force them all to live together multiculturally in a new artificial country called Yugoslavia. The communists held this artificial multicultural creation together with the threat of bayonets and firing squads. But after the collapse of communism, the various groups which had been forced to live together were at one another's throats, fighting to have their own territories where they could live by themselves again without outside interference. Actually, there's more to the story. There are two types of multiculturalists. There are the cold-blooded butcher types like Madeleine Albright and her kosher crew, who have no ideological commitment to multiculturalism, but who use it as a weapon in their ongoing war against the rest of the world. And there are the wet multiculturalists, the ideological multiculturalists, who really believe that no one should be permitted to mind his own business. They really believe that mixing all sorts of different people together and then having the government enforce their togetherness is the right way. When the bloodshed begins, the Madeleine Albright types laugh up their sleeves, and the wet types tear their hair out and try to figure what went wrong. After the Mardi Gras race riot in Seattle a month ago, the Madeleine Albright types were concentrating on keeping the news suppressed, keeping it from reaching the rest of the country, lest it cause some of the sheep to have second thoughts about the advantages of more diversity. The wet multiculturalists were wringing their hands in distress and whining, "Oh, why can't we just all learn to get along with each other?" The wets are still trying to figure it out, still making excuses for the blacks, still trying to explain their behavior in a politically correct way, and they are distressed at the reaction they are getting from a substantial portion of the white public. Many whites are continuing to express outrage in letters to newspapers and on the radio talk shows in Seattle over the failure of the police to protect whites and to arrest blacks in the riot from fear of being accused of racial profiling. They also are complaining about the reluctance of local prosecutors to charge black rioters with hate crimes, although many blacks were shouting, "Let's get a whitey," as they attacked whites. Actually, Seattle provides an amusing illustration of multiculturalism at work. The city is filled with very wet soccer moms and white yuppies, all claiming allegiance to multicultural ideals. Now they're trying to find excuses for why it didn't work. For wet multiculturalists to be happy in the long run, they need to practice their multiculturalism at a distance. They need to get the government to impose it on other people. When it comes home to roost in their own backyards, they have problems dealing with it. Well, there also are other chickens coming home to roost. Ever since the Second World War, the United States has been a hard-working attack dog and collection agency for the world's Jews. The whole world had treated the poor, innocent, inoffensive Jews so terribly that the U.S. government would force the rest of the world to pay reparations to the Jews for mistreating them. First, it was the Germans who were forced by the U.S. occupation army to cough up tens of billions of dollars for the Jews. Then it was the Swiss who were threatened by the U.S. Congress with boycotts if they didn't pay the Jews, and so it went. The French had taken some of their property, and the Jews wanted it back. The Swedes had traded with Germany during the war and had been paid by the Germans with Jewish gold, and the Jews wanted it back. I predicted a couple of years ago that eventually the Jews would get around to us. Most people thought me wrong when I made that prediction. After all, it was the United States Army which had pulled the Jews' chestnuts out of the fire in Europe during the Second World War. If the United States had remained neutral and had made plain its intention to remain neutral, there need never have been a war in Western Europe. Germany need never have fought France and Britain and the United States. Germany would have smashed the Soviet Union, destroyed communism, and chased the Jews out of Central and Eastern Europe forever. But the United States, under Franklin Roosevelt, secretly pledged its support to Britain if Britain would fight Germany until America could find an excuse to get into the war. It was American bombs that destroyed German cities and killed millions of German civilians. It was American intervention that permitted communism to survive and that also permitted hordes of communist rapists and murderers from the East to swarm over a defeated Germany. It was America that wreaked a Jewish vengeance on Germany and the German people for daring to raise their hands against the Jews. And after the war, it was America that gave billions of dollars of aid to the fledgling state of Israel and made it possible for the Jews of Israel to prevail over their neighbors and seize Arab land. So, how could the Jews possibly have the gall to demand reparations from America, which always has been their biggest benefactor? What possible basis could they have for demanding reparations from us? People thought me silly for making such a prediction. Well, those chickens started coming home to roost last year when the Jews filed claims against Ford and IBM and other American companies which had had subsidiaries in Germany before the Second World War. Because the German government had forced Jews to work in German defense industries during the war, and those industries included some of the German subsidiaries of American companies, the Jews claimed back wages from the American parent companies. But that was just the preliminary skirmish. Now a whole flock of chickens has arrived. In a lawsuit filed a few weeks ago in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, Jewish groups representing so-called Holocaust survivors are demanding $40 billion. The U.S. government, the Jews claim, failed to bomb and destroy the rail lines leading to Auschwitz, the big labor camp in Poland where the Germans produced synthetic rubber and other war materials using Jewish workers, and where, the Jews claim, 4 million of them died in gas chambers. According to the Jewish complaint, if the Americans had bombed the rail lines to Auschwitz, then the Germans wouldn't have been able to send all of those Jews to Auschwitz to be gassed, and they presumably would have survived the war. The Germans didn't bomb the rail lines to Auschwitz because there were many anti-Semites leading the American war effort, and they didn't want to do anything to save the Jews. To me, it sounds like a lame-brained argument. They say that if the Americans had bombed the rail lines to Auschwitz, then the Germans, being a pretty dull and unimaginative bunch, wouldn't have been able to figure out what to do with the Jews they intended to send there to be gassed. But the Americans didn't bomb the rail lines because they didn't really want to save the Jews. That's the argument being made. And the Jews want $40 billion from the U.S. government. The specific charge being made by the Jews against the Americans is complicity in genocide. It sounds preposterous, but I think it'll work. Can you imagine anyone in the media laughing at the Jews' claim that the Americans should pay them $40 billion for complicity in genocide? I think the media will take it all very seriously. Can you imagine any American politician speaking out against the Jews' claim? I think they will fall all over themselves to support it as the case begins to generate more headlines in the months ahead. I think that the Jews will get their money, and it will come from our pockets, and it will serve us right. And then the feeding frenzy will begin. And why not? The rule is never give a sucker an even break. And we certainly are the world's champion suckers. I don't mean to imply that in this latest claim, the Jews are simply holding out their hands and saying, give us your money. There will be all sorts of the standard legalistic hocus-pocus generated with smoke and mirrors and the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia in coming weeks and months. They will spend months presenting a huge amount of evidence and testimony to prove that we really are guilty of complicity in genocide and that we really do owe them $40 billion. That's easy enough to do, of course, when you have your opponents so terrified of being labeled anti-Semites that they won't put up a defense. For example, one batch of evidence the Jews will present in court is that in 1943 and 1944, 430,000 Jews were deported from Hungary to Auschwitz, and all that would have been required to prevent those deportations would have been the bombing of the rail bridges from Hungary to Poland. The Americans had air superiority and easily could have bombed the bridges if they had wanted to, but they didn't. The Americans, therefore, are guilty of complicity in genocide for the claimed gassing of those 430,000 Jews from Hungary. Furthermore, the Jews claimed those 430,000 Jews had $2 billion worth of valuables with them when they were deported. Gold jewelry, coins, precious stones, and so on. After the war, that $2 billion in valuables was looted by American troops. The Jews want it back from us. I think that it's poetic justice for the Jews to gouge that money out of a bunch of cowardly hypocrites like us who are afraid to stand up to them and have been their bully boys against the rest of the world for so long. And there are other chickens coming home to roost soon. For more than 50 years, we have helped the Jews plunder and murder the other peoples of the Middle East, not just the Palestinians, but the Egyptians and the Iraqis and the Lebanese and the Syrians and the Jordanians and the rest. And they've all just taken it. We kick them in the teeth at the behest of the Jews, and they don't kick back. We've assumed that they will keep on taking it forever without kicking back. A big part of the reason they've let us kick them in the teeth for so long is corrupt leadership. We've been paying off several of the governments over there to let the Jews do whatever they want to do. The Egyptian government of Hosni Mubarak even has passed laws prohibiting Egyptians from writing or saying anything critical of the Jews. That hopped-up little excuse for a king the Jordanians used to have until recently was afraid he would lose his status as an international jet-setter and playboy if he got out of line. The Saudis and many of the other oil sheikhs of the Persian Gulf are making too much money selling their oil to the Americans to give us any trouble. Just last month, the government of Lebanon banned an international conference of historical scholars scheduled for Beirut because in their writings, some of those scholars have deviated from the politically correct line laid down by the Jews on who was to blame for the Second World War and what happened during that war. The Jews asked the Lebanese government to ban the conference, and that's what the Lebanese government did. But all of that is beginning to change. A new generation of young, militant artists and intellectuals is opting out of the corrupt and shameful subservience that has been the rule for Arabs in the Middle East for so long. These young militants are capable of much more than simply strapping explosives around themselves under a coat and then walking into a crowd of Israelis and blowing themselves up. They are writing poetry and music and novels and essays and editorials and film scripts that their corrupt political leaders have declared illegal, but that nevertheless are circulating in hundreds of thousands of copies among their people. Young militant film directors are making films that their governments have banned, but that nevertheless are being seen on videos that go from hand to hand. Illegal songs that denounce Israel, the Jews, and the United States are being sold openly on CDs in Cairo and sung defiantly in public by young people. At the top of the charts now is the song, I Hate Israel. It was inspired by televised scenes of the Jews shooting a 12-year-old Palestinian boy to death in the arms of his father last September. Songs and films may not seem like much against U.S. aircraft carriers and Israeli terror weapons, but this rapidly growing militance among young Arab intellectuals and artists is very significant. In the past, the suicide bombers have been mostly young religious fanatics, poor and uneducated, and they weren't much better at building an effective bomb than the average Ku Kluxer in this country. The new generation of bomb makers will be brighter, better educated, wealthier, and better connected. Some of them, like Osama bin Laden of the older generation, also may be religious, but the important thing is that the affluent sons and daughters of the corrupt Arab leadership are finding it fashionable now to be nationally conscious, to support the oppressed Palestinians and Iraqis, and to take action against the newly perceived enemies of their people. I have no specific knowledge of what those actions will be, of course, but I suspect that they will be more sophisticated and more carefully planned and executed than the suicide bombings of the past, or even the World Trade Center bombing in New York in 1993. If we see unexpected outbreaks of foot-and-mouth disease at 50 different locations at the same time in the United States, with the consequent devastation of our entire livestock industry, we'll know that some of our chickens have come home to roost. George Bush and the other corrupt flunkies of the Jews in America can rattle their aircraft carriers and rage about cowardly acts of terrorism, and the corrupt leaders of the Arab world can imprison or shoot their own sons and daughters in an effort to hang on to their wealth and power. But the chickens will keep coming. That is a promise. It's foolish even to think about trying to keep the chickens away at this late date. Historical events usually are connected. One follows from another. The course of history can be changed if one looks ahead far enough. But it's like changing the course of a moving locomotive. We won't accomplish much by pushing on the side of the locomotive as it's going past. But if we get far enough ahead and move the tracks in front of the locomotive, we can change the direction in which it will go. We ceased being vigilant a long time ago. We became short-sighted. We allowed weak and corrupt men to lead us for too long. We allowed the Jews into our society. We will pay the price for that, and it will be a terrible price. But perhaps even now, we can plan ahead and do something about moving the tracks in front of the locomotive. Thanks for being with me again today.